The inspector began telling Nekhludov of a fight that had lately taken place among the convicts, which had ended by one man being killed. The story was interrupted by the entrance of Maslova, who was accompanied by a jailer. Nekhludov saw her through the doorway before she had noticed the inspector. She was following the warder briskly, smiling and tossing her head. When she saw the inspector, she suddenly changed and gazed at him with a frightened look. But, quickly recovering, she addressed Nekhludov boldly and gaily. "How do you do?" she said, drawling out her words, and smilingly took his hand and shook it vigorously, not like the first time. "Here, I've brought you a petition to sign," said Nekhludov, rather surprised by the boldness with which she greeted him today. "The advocate has written out a petition which you will have to sign, and then we shall send it to Petersburg."
"All right. That can be done. Anything you like," she said with a wink and a smile.
And Nekhludov drew a folded paper from his pocket and went up to the table. "May she sign it here?" asked Nekhludov, turning to the inspector.
"It's all right, it's all right. Sit down, here's a pen. You can write," said the inspector.
"I could at one time," she said.
And after arranging her skirt and the sleeves of her jacket, she sat down at the table, smiled awkwardly, took the pen with her small, energetic hand, and glanced at Nekhludov with a laugh. Nekhludov told her what to write and pointed out the place where to sign. Sighing deeply as she dipped her pen into the ink and carefully shaking some drops off the pen, she wrote her name.
"Is it all?"
she asked, looking from Nekhludov to the inspector and putting the pen now on the inkstand, now on the papers. "I have a few words to tell you," Nekhludov said, taking the pen from her.
"All right, tell me," she said.
And suddenly, as if remembering something, or feeling sleepy, she grew serious. The inspector rose and left the room, and Nekhludov remained with her. Chapter 48 Maslova Refuses to Marry. The jailer who had brought Maslova in sat on a window-sill at some distance from them. The decisive moment had come for Nekhludov. He had been incessantly blaming himself for not having told her the principal thing at the first interview, and was now determined to tell her that he would marry her. She was sitting at the further side of the table. Nekhludov sat down opposite her. It was light in the room, and Nekhludov for the first time saw her face quite near. He distinctly saw the crow's feet round her eyes, the wrinkles round her mouth, and the swollen eyelids. He felt more sorry than before. Leaning over the table so as not to be heard by the jailer, a man of Jewish type with grisly whiskers who sat by the window, Nekhludov said, "Should this petition come to nothing, we shall appeal to the Emperor. All that is possible shall be done."
"There, now, if we had had a proper advocate from the first," she interrupted. "My defendant was quite a silly. He did nothing but pay me compliments," she said, and laughed. "If it had then been known that I was acquainted with you, it would have been another matter. They think everyone's a thief."
"How strange she is today," Nekhludov thought, and was just going to say what he had on his mind when she began again.
"There's something I want to say. We have here an old woman, such a fine one, do you know? She just surprises everyone. She is imprisoned for nothing, and her son, too, and everybody knows they're innocent, though they are accused of having set fire to a house. Do you know, hearing I was acquainted with you, she says, 'Tell him to ask to see my son. He'll tell him all about it.'"
Thus spoke Maslova, turning her head from side to side and glancing at Nekhludov.
"Their name's Menchov. Well, will you do it? Such a fine old thing, you know. You can see at once she's innocent. You'll do it, there's a dear."
And she smiled, glanced up at him, and then cast down her eyes. "All right, I'll find out about them," Nekhludov said, more and more astonished by her free and easy manner. "But I was going to speak to you about myself. Do you remember what I told you last time?"
"You said a lot last time. What was it you told me?"
she said, continuing to smile and to turn her head from side to side. "I said I had come to ask you to forgive me," he began.
"What's the use of that? Forgive, forgive. Where's the good of—"
"To atone for my sin, not by mere words, but in deed. I have made up my mind to marry you." An expression of fear suddenly came over her face. Her squinting eyes remained fixed on him, and yet seemed not to be looking at him.
"What's that for?"
she said with an angry frown. "I feel that it is my duty before God to do it."
"What God have you found now? You're not saying what you ought to. God, indeed. What God?"
"You ought to have remembered God then," she said, and stopped with her mouth open. It was only now that Nekhludoff noticed that her breath smelled of spirits, and that he understood the cause of her excitement. "Try and be calm," he said.
"Why should I be calm?"
she began, quickly, flushing scarlet.
"I'm a convict, and you are a gentleman of the prince. There's no need for you to soil yourself by touching me. You go to your princesses. My price is a 10-ruble note."
"However cruelly you may speak, you cannot express what I myself am feeling," he said, trembling all over. "You cannot imagine to what extent I feel myself guilty towards you."
"Feel yourself guilty?"
she said, angrily mimicking him.
"You did not feel so then, but threw me 100 roubles. That's your price."
"I know, I know. But what is to be done now?" said Nekhludoff. "I have decided not to leave you, and what I have said I shall do."
"And I say you shan't,"
she said, and laughed aloud.
"Katyusha," he said, touching her hand, "you go away. I'm a convict and you a prince, and you've no business here,"
she cried, pulling away her hand, her whole appearance transformed by her wrath.
"You've got pleasure out of me in this life, and want to save yourself through me in the life to come. You are disgusting to me, your spectacles and the whole of your dirty fat mug. Go, go!"
she screamed, starting to her feet. The jailer came up to them.
"What are you kicking up this row for? That won't—"
"Let her alone, please," said Nekhludoff.
"She must not forget herself," said the jailer.
"Please wait a little," said Nekhludoff. And the jailer returned to the window. Maslova sat down again, dropping her eyes and firmly clasping her small hands. Nekhludoff stooped over her, not knowing what to do. "You do not believe me?" he said.
"That you mean to marry me?
It will never be.
I'll rather hang myself, so there."
"Well, still, I shall go on serving you."
"That's your affair, only I don't want anything from you. I'm telling you the plain truth," she said. "Oh, why did I not die then?"
she added, and began to cry piteously. Nekhludoff could not speak. Her tears infected him. She lifted her eyes, looked at him in surprise, and began to wipe her tears with her kerchief. The jailer came up again and reminded them that it was time to part. Maslova rose.
"You are excited.
If it is possible, I shall come again tomorrow. You think it over," said Nekhludoff. She gave him no answer, and, without looking up, followed the jailer out of the room.
"Well, lass, you'll have rare times now," Karabluva said, when Maslova returned to the cell. "Seems he's mighty sweet on you. Make the most of it while he's after you. He'll help you out. Rich people can do anything." "Yes, that's so," remarked the watchman's wife with her musical voice. "When a poor man thinks of getting married, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. But a rich man need only make up his mind, and it's done. We knew a toff like that, ducky. What do you think he did?" "Well, have you spoken about my affairs?" the old woman asked.
But Maslova gave her fellow prisoners no answer. She lay down on the shelf bedstead, her squinting eyes fixed on a corner of the room, and lay there until the evening. A painful struggle went on in her soul. What Nekhludoff had told her called up the memory of that world in which she had suffered, and which she had left without having understood, hating it. She now feared to wake from the trance in which she was living. Not having arrived at any conclusion when evening came, she again bought some vodka and drank with her companions. Chapter 49. Vera Dukhova. "So this is what it means. This," thought Nekhludoff, as he left the prison, only now fully understanding his crime. If he had not tried to expiate his guilt, he would never have found out how great his crime was. Nor was this all. She, too, would never have felt the whole horror of what had been done to her. He only now saw what he had done to the soul of this woman. Only now she saw and understood what had been done to her. Up to this time, Nekhludoff had played with a sensation of self-admiration, had admired his own remorse. Now he was simply filled with horror. He knew he could not throw her up now, and yet he could not imagine what would come of their relations to one another. Just as he was going out, a jailer, with a disagreeable, insinuating countenance, and a cross and medals on his breast, came up and handed him a note with an air of mystery.
"Here is a note from a certain person, Your Honour," he said to Nekhludov as he gave him the envelope.
"What person?"
"You will know when you read it. A political prisoner. I'm in that ward, so she asked me, and though it is against the rules, still feelings of humanity."
The jailer spoke in an unnatural manner. Nekhludov was surprised that a jailer of the ward where political prisoners were kept should pass notes inside the very prison walls, and almost within sight of everyone. He did not then know that this was both a jailer and a spy. However, he took the note and read it on coming out of the prison. The note was written in a bold hand and ran as follows: "Having heard that you visit the prison and are interested in the case of a criminal prisoner, the desire of seeing you arose in me. Ask for permission to see me. I can give you a good deal of information concerning your protégé and also our group. Yours gratefully, Vera Dukhova." Vera Dukhova had been a schoolteacher in an out-of-the-way village of the Novgorod government, where Nekhludov and some friends of his had once put up while bear-hunting. Nekhludov gladly and vividly recalled those old days and his acquaintance with Dukhova. It was just before Lent, in an isolated spot 40 miles from the railway. The hunt had been successful, 2 bears had been killed, and the company were having dinner before starting on their return journey, when the master of the hut where they were putting up came in to say that the deacon's daughter wanted to speak to Prince Nekhludov.
"Is she pretty?" someone asked.
"None of that, please," Nekhludov said, and rose with a serious look on his face. Wiping his mouth and wondering what the deacon's daughter might want of him, he went into the host's private hut. There he found a girl with a felt hat and a warm cloak on, a sinewy, ugly girl. Only her eyes, with their arched brows, were beautiful.
"Here, miss, speak to him," said the old housewife. "This is the prince himself. I shall go out meanwhile."
"In what way can I be of service to you?" Nekhludov asked.
I see you are throwing away your money on such nonsense. On hunting," began the girl in great confusion. "I know. I only want one thing, to be of use to the people, and I can do nothing because I know nothing."
Her eyes were so truthful, so kind, and her expression of resoluteness and yet bashfulness was so touching that Nekhludov, as it often happened to him, suddenly felt as if he were in her position, understood and sympathized. "What can I do, then?"
"I am a teacher, but should like to follow a course of study, and I am not allowed to do so. That is, not that I am not allowed to. They'd allow me to, but I have not got the means. Give them to me, and when I have finished the course I shall repay you. I am thinking the rich kill bears and give the peasants drink. All this is bad. Why should they not do good? I only want 80 rubles. But if you don't wish to, never mind," she added gravely.
"On the contrary, I am very grateful to you for this opportunity. I will bring it at once," said Nekhludov. He went out into the passage and there met one of his comrades who had been overhearing his conversation. Paying no heed to his chaffing, Nekhludov got the money out of his bag and took it to her. "Oh, please do not thank me. It is I who should thank you," he said. It was pleasant to remember all this now, pleasant to remember that he had nearly had a quarrel with an officer who tried to make an objectionable joke about it, and how another of his comrades had taken his part, which led to a closer friendship between them. How successful the whole of that hunting expedition had been, and how happy he had felt when returning to the railway station that night. The line of sledges, the horses in tandem, glide quickly along the narrow road that lies through the forest, now between high trees, now between low firs weighed down by the snow, caked in heavy lumps on their branches. A red light flashes in the dark. Someone lights an aromatic cigarette. Joseph, a bear driver, keeps running from sledge to sledge, up to his knees in snow, and while putting things to rights he speaks about the elk, which are now going about on the deep snow and gnawing the bark off the aspen trees, of the bears that are lying asleep in their deep hidden dens, and his breath comes warm through the opening in the sledge cover. All this came back to Nekhludov's mind, but above all the joyous sense of health, strength, and freedom from care, the lungs breathing in the frosty air so deeply that the fur cloak is drawn tightly on his chest. The fine snow drops off the low branches onto his face. His body is warm, his face feels fresh, and his soul is free from care, self-reproach, fear,
or desire. How beautiful it was! And now, oh God, what torment, what trouble!
Evidently Vera Dukhova was a revolutionist, and imprisoned as such. He must see her, especially as she promised to advise him how to lighten Maslova's lot. Chapter 50. The Vice Governor of the Prison. Awaking early the next morning, Nekhludov remembered what he had done the day before and was seized with fear. But in spite of this fear, he was more determined than ever to continue what he had begun. Conscious of a sense of duty, he left the house and went to see Maslennikov in order to obtain from him a permission to visit Maslova in prison, and also the Mienshovs, mother and son, about whom Maslova had spoken to him. Nekhludov had known this Maslennikov a long time. They had been in the regiment together. At that time Maslennikov was treasurer to the regiment. He was a kind-hearted and zealous officer, knowing and wishing to know nothing beyond the regiment and the imperial family. Now Nekhludov saw him as an administrator who had exchanged the regiment for an administrative office in the government where he lived. He was married to a rich and energetic woman who had forced him to exchange military for civil service. She laughed at him and caressed him, as if he were her own pet animal. Nekhludov had been to see them once during the winter, but the couple were so uninteresting to him that he had not gone again. At the sight of Nekhludov, Maslennikov's face beamed all over. He had the same fat, red face, and was as corpulent and as well-dressed as in his military days. Then he used to be always dressed in a well-brushed uniform, made according to the latest fashion, tightly fitting his chest and shoulders. Now it was a civil service uniform he wore, and that too tightly fitted his well-fed body and showed off his broad chest, and was cut according to the latest fashion. In spite of the difference in age, Maslennikov was 40, the two men were very familiar with one another.
"Hello, old fellow! How good of you to come! Let us go and see my wife. I've just 10 minutes to spare before the meeting. My chief is away, you know. I'm at the head of the government administration," he said, unable to disguise his satisfaction.
"I have come on business."
"What is it?"
said Maslennikov, in an anxious and severe tone, putting himself at once on his guard.
"There is a person whom I am very much interested in prison." At the word prison, Maslennikov's face grew stern. "And I should like to have an interview in the office, and not in the common visiting room. I have been told it depended on you."
"Certainly, mon cher,"
said Maslennikov, putting both hands on Nekhludov's knees, as if to tone down his grandeur.
"But, remember, I am monarch only for an hour."
"Then will you give me an order that will enable me to see her?"
"It's a woman?"
"Yes."
"What is she there for?"
"Poisoning. But she has been unjustly condemned."
"Yes, there you have it. Your justice administered by jury. Il n'en font point d'autre," he said for some unknown reason in French. "I know you do not agree with me, but it can't be helped. C'est mon opinion bien artée," he added, giving utterance to an opinion he had for the last 12 months been reading in the retrograde conservative paper. "I know you are a liberal."
"I don't know whether I am a liberal or something else," Nekhludov said, smiling.
It always surprised him to find himself ranked with a political party and called a liberal, when he maintained that a man should be heard before he was judged, that before being tried all men were equal, that nobody at all ought to be ill-treated and beaten, and especially those who had not yet been condemned by law. "I don't know whether I am a liberal or not, but I do know that however hard the present way of conducting a trial is, it is better than the old."
"And whom have you for an advocate?"
"I have spoken to Fanarin."
"Dear me, Fanarin,"
said Maslennikov, with a grimace, recollecting how this Fanarin had examined him as a witness at a trial the year before, and had, in the politest manner, held him up to ridicule for half an hour.
"I should not advise you to have anything to do with him. Fanarin est un homme tard."
"I have one more request to make," said Nekhludov, without answering him. "There's a girl whom I knew long ago. A teacher. She is a very pitiable little thing, and is now also imprisoned, and would like to see me. Could you give me a permission to visit her?" Maslennikov bent his head on one side and considered.
"She's a political one?"
"Yes, I have been told so."
Well, you see, only relatives get permission to visit political prisoners. Still, I'll give you an open order. Je sais que vous n'abuserez pas. Now, what's the name of your protégé? Dukhova? Elle est jolie?
It is.
Maslennikov shook his head disapprovingly, went up to the table, and wrote on a sheet of paper with a printed heading, "The bearer, Prince Dmitri Ivanovich Nekhludov, is to be allowed to interview in the prison office the Mishanka Maslova, and also the medical assistant Dukhova." And he finished with an elaborate flourish.
"Now you'll be able to see what order we've got there. And it is very difficult to keep order. It is so crowded, especially with people condemned to exile. But I watch strictly and love the work. You will see they are very comfortable and contented, but one must know how to deal with them. Only a few days ago we had a little trouble. Insubordination. Another would have called it mutiny and would have made many miserable, but with us it all passed quietly. We must have solicitude on the one hand, firmness and power on the other."
And he clenched the fat, white, turquoise-ringed fist, which issued out of the starched cuff of his shirt sleeve, fastened with a gold stud.
"Solicitude and firm power."
"Well, I don't know about that," said Nekhludov. "I went there twice and felt very much depressed."
"Do you know, you ought to get acquainted with the Countess Pasek," continued Maslennikov, growing talkative. "She has given herself up entirely to this sort of work. Elle fait beaucoup de bien. Thanks to her, and perhaps I may add without false modesty to me, everything has been changed, changed in such a way that the former horrors no longer exist, and they are really quite comfortable there. Well, you'll see. There's Fanarin. I do not know him personally. Besides, my social position keeps our ways apart, but he is positively a bad man, and besides, he takes the liberty of saying such things in the court. Such things!"
"Well, thank you," Nekhludov said, taking the paper, and without listening further he bade good day to his former comrade.
"And won't you go in to see my wife?"
"No, pray excuse me, I have no time now."
"Dear me, why, she will never forgive me,"
said Maslennikov, accompanying his old acquaintance down to the first landing, as he was in the habit of doing to persons of not the greatest, but the second greatest importance, with whom he classed Nekhludov.
"Now do go in, if only for a moment."
But Nekhludov remained firm, and while the footman and the doorkeeper rushed to give him his stick and overcoat, and opened the door outside of which there stood a policeman, Nekhludov repeated that he really could not come in.
"Well, then, on Thursday, please. It is her at home. I will tell her you will come,"
shouted Maslennikov from the stairs. Chapter 51. The Cells. Nekhludov drove that day straight from Maslennikov's to the prison, and went to the inspector's lodging, which he now knew. He was again struck by the sounds of the same piano of inferior quality, but this time it was not a rhapsody that was being played, but exercises by Clementi, again with the same vigour, distinctness, and quickness. The servant with the bandaged eye said the inspector was in, and showed Nekhludov to a small drawing-room, in which there stood a sofa, and, in front of it, a table with a large lamp, which stood on a piece of crochet-work, and the paper shade of which was burnt on one side. The chief inspector entered with his usual sad and weary look.
"Take a seat, please. What is it you want?" he said, buttoning up the middle button of his uniform.
"I have just been to the vice-governor's and got this order from him. I should like to see the prisoner Maslova."
"Markova?"
asked the inspector, unable to hear distinctly because of the music.
"Maslova!" "Well, yes."
The inspector got up and went to the door, whence proceeded Clementi's roulades.
"Mary, can't you stop just a minute?" he said, in a voice that showed that this music was the bane of his life. "One can't hear a word."
The piano was silent, but one could hear the sound of reluctant steps, and someone looked in at the door. The inspector seemed to feel eased by the interval of silence, lit a thick cigarette of weak tobacco, and offered one to Nekhludov. Nekhludov refused.
"What I want is to see Maslova." "Oh, yes, that can be managed."
"Now then, what do you want?" he said, addressing a little girl of 5 or 6, who came into the room and walked up to her father, with her head turned towards Nekhludov, and her eyes fixed on him.
"There, now you'll fall down," said the inspector, smiling, as the little girl ran up to him, and, not looking where she was going, caught her foot in a little rug.
"Well, then, if I may, I shall go."
"It's not very convenient to see Maslova today,"
said the inspector. "How's that?"
"Well, you know, it's all your own fault," said the inspector with a slight smile. "Prince, give her no money into her hands. If you like, give it me. I will keep it for her. You see, you gave her some money yesterday. She got some spirits. It's an evil we cannot manage to root out. And today she is quite tipsy, even violent."
"Can this be true?"
"Oh, yes, it is. I have even been obliged to have recourse to severe measures and to put her into a separate cell. She is a quiet woman in an ordinary way, but please do not give her any money. These people are so..."
What had happened the day before came vividly back to Nekhludoff's mind, and again he was seized with fear. "And Dukhova, a political prisoner, might I see her?"
"Yes, if you like,"
said the inspector. He embraced the little girl, who was still looking at Nekhludoff, got up, and tenderly motioning her aside, went into the anteroom. Hardly had he got into the overcoat which the maid helped him to put on, and before he had reached the door, the distinct sounds of Clemente's roulades again began.
"She entered the conservatoire, but there is such disorder there. She has a great gift," said the inspector as they went down the stairs. "She means to play at concerts."
The inspector and Nekhludoff arrived at the prison. The gates were instantly opened as they appeared. The jailers, with their fingers lifted to their caps, followed the inspector with their eyes. Four men, with their heads half-shaved, who were carrying tubs filled with something, cringed when they saw the inspector. One of them frowned angrily, his black eyes glaring.
"Of course, a talent like that must be developed. It would not do to bury it, but in a small lodging, you know, it is rather hard."
The inspector went on with the conversation, taking no notice of the prisoners.
"Who is it you want to see?"
"Dukhova."
"Oh, she's in the tower. You'll have to wait a little," he said.
"Might I not meanwhile see the prisoners Menshov, mother and son, who are accused of incendiarism?"
"Oh, yes. Cell number 21. Yes, they can be sent for."
"But might I not see Menshov in his cell?"
"Oh, you'll find the waiting room more pleasant."
"No, I should prefer the cell. It is more interesting."
"Well, you have found something to be interested in."
Here the assistant, a smartly dressed officer, entered the side door.
"Here, see the prince into Menshov's cell, number 21, said the inspector to his assistant, "and then take him to the office, and I'll go and call, what's her name, Vera Dukhova."
The inspector's assistant was young, with dyed moustaches and diffusing the smell of eau de cologne.
"This way, please," he said to Nekhludoff, with a pleasant smile. "Our establishment interests you?"
"Yes, it does interest me. And besides, I look upon it as a duty to help a man who I heard was confined here, though innocent." The assistant shrugged his shoulders.
"Yes, that may happen,"
he said quietly, politely stepping aside to let the visitor enter the stinking corridor first.
"But it also happens that they lie.
Here we are." The doors of the cells were open, and some of the prisoners were in the corridor. The assistant nodded slightly to the jailers and cast a side glance at the prisoners, who, keeping close to the wall, crept back to their cells or stood like soldiers with their arms at their sides, following the official with their eyes. After passing through one corridor, the assistant showed Nekhludoff into another to the left, separated from the first by an iron door. This corridor was darker and smelt even worse than the first. The corridor had doors on both sides with little holes in them about an inch in diameter. There was only an old jailer with an unpleasant face in this corridor.
"Where is Menshov?"
asked the inspector's assistant.
"The eighth cell to the left."
"And these, are they occupied?" asked Nekhludoff.
"Yes, all but one." Chapter 52. Number 21.
"May I look in?" asked Nekhludoff.
"Oh, certainly,"
answered the assistant, smiling, and turned to the jailer with some question. Nekhludoff looked into one of the little holes and saw a tall young man pacing up and down the cell. When the man heard someone at the door, he looked up with a frown, but continued walking up and down. Nekhludoff looked into another hole. His eye met another large eye looking out of the hole at him, and he quickly stepped aside. In the third cell he saw a very small man asleep on the bed, covered, head and all, with his prison cloak. In the fourth, a broad-faced man was sitting with his elbows on his knees and his head low down. At the sound of footsteps, this man raised his head and looked up. His face, especially his large eyes, bore the expression of hopeless dejection. One could see that it did not even interest him to know who was looking into his cell. Whoever it might be, he evidently hoped for nothing good from him. Nekhludov was seized with dread and went to Menshov's cell, number 21, without stopping to look through any more holes. The jailer unlocked the door and opened it. A young man with long neck, well-developed muscles, a small head, and kind, round eyes, stood by the bed, hastily putting on his cloak, and looking at the newcomers with a frightened face. Nekhludov was specially struck by the kind, round eyes that were throwing frightened and inquiring glances in turns at him, at the jailer and at the assistant, and back again.
"Here's a gentleman wants to inquire into your affair."
"Thank you kindly."
"Yes, I was told about you," Nekhludov said, going through the cell up to the dirty, grated window. "And I should like to hear all about it from yourself."
Menshov also came up to the window, and at once started telling his story, at first looking shyly at the inspector's assistant, but growing gradually bolder. When the assistant left the cell and went into the corridor to give some order, the man grew quite bold. The story was told with the accent and in the manner common to a most ordinary good peasant lad. To hear it told by a prisoner dressed in this degrading clothing and inside a prison seemed very strange to Nekhludov. Nekhludov listened and at the same time kept looking around him, at the low bedstead with its straw mattress, the window and the dirty damp wall, and the piteous face and form of this unfortunate, disfigured peasant in his prison cloak and shoes, and he felt sadder and sadder, and would have liked not to believe what this good-natured fellow was saying. It seemed too dreadful to think that men could do such a thing as to take a man, dress him in convict clothes, and put him in this horrible place without any reason, only because he himself had been injured. And yet the thought that this seemingly true story, told with such a good-natured expression on the face, might be an invention and a lie, was still more dreadful. This was the story. The village public housekeeper had enticed the young fellow's wife. He tried to get justice by all sorts of means, but everywhere the public housekeeper managed to bribe the officials and was acquitted. Once he took his wife back by force, but she ran away next day. Then he came to demand her back, but though he saw her when he came in, the public housekeeper told him she was not there and ordered him to go away. He would not go, so the public housekeeper and his servant beat him so that they drew blood. The next day a fire broke out in the public house, and the young man and his mother were accused of having set the house on fire. He had not set it on fire, but was visiting a friend at the time.
"And it is true that you did not set it on fire?"
"It never entered my head to do it, sir. It must be my enemy that did it himself. They say he had only just insured it. Then they said it was mother and I that did it, and that we had threatened him. It is true I once did go for him. My heart couldn't stand it any longer."
"Can this be true?"
"God is my witness, it is true. Oh, sir, be so good."
And Nekhludov had some difficulty to prevent him from bowing down to the ground.
"You see, I'm perishing without any reason."
His face quivered, and he turned up the sleeve of his cloak and began to cry, wiping the tears with the sleeve of his dirty shirt.
"Are you ready?"
asked the assistant.
"Yes. Well, cheer up. We will consult a good lawyer, and we'll do what we can," said Nekhludov, and went out.
Menshov stood close to the door, so that the jailer knocked him in shutting it, and while the jailer was locking it, he remained looking out through the little hole. Chapter 53. Victims of Government. Passing back along the broad corridor, it was dinner-time and the cell doors were open, among the men dressed in their light yellow cloaks, short, wide trousers and prison shoes, who were looking eagerly at him, Nekhludov felt a strange mixture of sympathy for them, and horror and perplexity at the conduct of those who put and kept them here, and, besides, he felt, he knew not why, ashamed of himself calmly examining it all. In one of the corridors someone ran, clattering with his shoes, in at the door of a cell. Several men came out from here and stood in Nekhludov's way, bowing to him.
"Please, Your Honour, we don't know what to call you. Get our affair settled somehow."
"I am not an official. I know nothing about it."
"Well, anyhow, you come from outside. Tell somebody.
"'One of the authorities, if need be,' said an indignant voice. "'Show some pity on us, as a human being. "'Here we are suffering the second month for nothing.'
"'What do you mean? Why?' said Nekhludov.
"'Why? We ourselves don't know why, but are sitting here the second month.'
"'Yes, it's quite true, and it is owing to an accident,' said the inspector. "'These people were taken up because they had no passports "'and ought to have been sent back to their native government. "'But the prison there is burnt, and the local authorities have written, "'asking us not to send them on. "'So we have sent all the other passportless people to their different governments, "'but are keeping these.'
"'What? For no other reason than that?' Nekhludov exclaimed, stopping at the door. A crowd of about 40 men, all dressed in prison clothes, surrounded him and the assistant, and several began talking at once. The assistant stopped them.
"'Let some one of you speak.'
A tall, good-looking peasant, a stonemason of about 50, stepped out from the rest. He told Nekhludov that all of them had been ordered back to their homes and were now being kept in prison because they had no passports, yet they had passports which were only a fortnight overdue. The same thing had happened every year. They had many times omitted to renew their passports till they were overdue, and nobody had ever said anything. But this year they had been taken up, and were being kept in prison the second month as if they were criminals.
"'We are all masons, and belong to the same artel. We are told that the prison in our government is burnt, but this is not our fault. Do help us!'
Nekhludov listened, but hardly understood what the good-looking old man was saying, because his attention was riveted to a large, dark-grey, many-legged louse that was creeping along the good-looking man's cheek.
"'How's that? Is it possible for such a reason?'
Nekhludov said, turning to the assistant.
"'Yes, they should have been sent off and taken back to their homes,' calmly said the assistant, "'but they seem to have been forgotten or something.'
Before the assistant had finished, a small, nervous man, also in prison dress, came out of the crowd, and, strangely contorting his mouth, began to say that they were being ill-used for nothing.
"'Worse than dogs,'
he began.
"'Now, now, not too much of this. Hold your tongue, or you know—'
"'What do I know?' screamed the little man desperately. "'What is our crime?'
"'Silence!' shouted the assistant, and the little man was silent. "'But what is the meaning of all this?' Nekhludov thought to himself as he came out of the cell, while 100 eyes were fixed upon him through the openings of the cell doors and from the prisoners that met him, making him feel as if he were running the gauntlet. "'Is it really possible that perfectly innocent people are kept here?' Nekhludov uttered when they left the corridor.
"'What would you have us do? They lie so. To hear them talk, they are all of them innocent,'
said the inspector's assistant.
"'But it does happen that some are really imprisoned for nothing.'
"'Well, these have done nothing.'
"'Yes, we must admit it. Still, the people are fearfully spoiled. There are such types, desperate fellows, with whom one has to look sharp. Today, two of that sort had to be punished.'
"'Punished? How?
Flogged with a birch rod by order.
But corporal punishment is abolished.
Not for such as are deprived of their rights. They are still liable to it.'
Nekhludov thought of what he had seen the day before, while waiting in the hall, and now understood that the punishment was then being inflicted, and the mixed feeling of curiosity, depression, perplexity, and moral nausea that grew into physical sickness took hold of him more strongly than ever before. Without listening to the inspector's assistant, or looking round, he hurriedly left the corridor and went to the office. The inspector was in the office, occupied with other business, and had forgotten to send for Dukova. He only remembered his promise to have her called when Nekhludov entered the office.
"'Sit down, please. I'll send for her at once,' said the inspector.
Chapter 54 Prisoners and Friends. The office consisted of two rooms. The first room, with a large, dilapidated stove and two dirty windows, had a black measure for measuring the prisoners in one corner, and in another corner hung a large image of Christ, as is usual in places where they torture people. In this room stood several jailers. In the next room sat about 20 persons, men and women in groups and in pairs, talking in low voices. There was a writing table by the window. The inspector sat down by the table and offered Nekhludov a chair beside him. Nekhludov sat down and looked at the people in the room. The first who drew his attention was a young man with a pleasant face, dressed in a short jacket, standing in front of a middle-aged woman with dark eyebrows, and he was eagerly telling her something and gesticulating with his hands. Beside them sat an old man with blue spectacles, holding the hand of a young woman in prisoner's clothes who was telling him something. A schoolboy, with a fixed, frightened look on his face, was gazing at the old man. In one corner sat a pair of lovers. She was quite young and pretty, and had short, fair hair, looked energetic, and was elegantly dressed. He had fine features, wavy hair, and wore a rubber jacket. They sat in their corner and seemed stupefied with love. Nearest to the table sat a grey-haired woman, dressed in black, evidently the mother of a young, consumptive-looking fellow in the same kind of jacket. Her head lay on his shoulder. She was trying to say something, but the tears prevented her from speaking. She began several times, but had to stop. The young man held a paper in his hand, and, apparently not knowing what to do, kept folding and pressing it with an angry look on his face. Beside them was a short-haired, stout, rosy girl with very prominent eyes, dressed in a grey dress and a cape. She sat beside the weeping mother, tenderly stroking her. Everything about this girl was beautiful. Her large white hands, her short wavy hair, her firm nose and lips. But the chief charm of her face lay in her kind, truthful, hazel eyes. The beautiful eyes turned away from the mother for a moment when Nekhludov came in and met his look, but she turned back at once and said something to the mother. Not far from the lovers, a dark, dishevelled man with a gloomy face sat angrily talking to a beardless visitor who looked as if he belonged to the Skoptsi sect. At the very door stood a young man in a rubber jacket who seemed more concerned about the impression he produced on the onlooker than about what he was saying. Nekhludov, sitting by the inspector's side, looked round with strained curiosity. A little boy with closely cropped hair came up to him and addressed him in a thin little voice.
"And whom are you waiting for?"
Nekhludov was surprised at the question, but looking at the boy and seeing the serious little face with its bright, attentive eyes fixed on him, answered him seriously that he was waiting for a woman of his acquaintance.
"Is she, then, your sister?"
the boy asked. "No, not my sister," Nekhludov answered in surprise. "And with whom are you here?" he inquired of the boy.
"I? With Mama. She's a political one," he replied.
"Mary Pavlovna, take Kolya," said the inspector, evidently considering Nekhludov's conversation with the boy illegal.
Mary Pavlovna, the beautiful girl who had attracted Nekhludov's attention, rose tall and erect, and with firm, almost manly steps, approached Nekhludov and the boy.
"What is he asking you? Who are you?"
she inquired with a slight smile, and looking straight into his face with a trustful look in her kind, prominent eyes, and as simply as if there could be no doubt whatever that she was and must be on sisterly terms with everybody.
"He likes to know everything,"
she said, looking at the boy with so sweet and kind a smile that both the boy and Nekhludov were obliged to smile back.
"He was asking me whom I have come to see." "Mary Pavlovna, it is against the rules to speak to strangers, you know it is," said the inspector.
"All right, all right," she said, and went back to the consumptive lad's mother, holding Kolya's little hand in her large white one, while he continued gazing up into her face.
"Whose is this little boy?" Nekhludov asked of the inspector.
"His mother is a political prisoner, and he was born in prison," said the inspector, in a pleased tone, as if glad to point out how exceptional his establishment was.
"Is it possible?"
"Yes, and now he is going to Siberia with her."
"And that young girl?"
"I cannot answer your question," said the inspector, shrugging his shoulders. "Besides, here is Dukova."
Chapter 55. Vera Dukova Explains. Through a door at the back of the room entered, with a wriggling gait, the thin, yellow Vera Dukova, with her large, kind eyes.
"Thanks for having come," she said, pressing Nekhludov's hand. "Do you remember me? Let us sit down."
"I did not expect to see you like this."
"Oh, I am very happy. It is so delightful that I desire nothing better," said Vera Dukova, with the usual expression of fright in the large, kind, round eyes fixed on Nekhludov, and twisting the terribly thin, sinewy neck, surrounded by the shabby, crumpled, dirty collar of her bodice. Nekhludov asked her how she came to be in prison.
In answer, she began relating all about her affairs with great animation. Her speech was intermingled with a great many long words, such as propaganda, disorganization, social groups, sections and subsections, about which she seemed to think everybody knew, but which Nekhludov had never heard of. She told him all about the secrets of the Narodovolstvo,
literally, people's freedom,
a revolutionary movement, evidently convinced that he was pleased to hear them. Nekhludov looked at her miserable little neck, her thin, unkempt hair, and wondered why she had been doing all these strange things, and why she was now telling all this to him. He pitied her, but not as he had pitied Menshov, the peasant, kept for no fault of his own in the stinking prison. She was pitiable because of the confusion that filled her mind. It was clear that she considered herself a heroine, and was ready to give her life for a cause, though she could hardly have explained what that cause was, and in what its success would lie. The business that Vera Dukhova wanted to see Nekhludov about was the following. A friend of hers, who had not even belonged to their sub-group, as she expressed it, had been arrested with her about 5 months before, and imprisoned in the Petropavlovsky fortress because some prohibited books and papers, which she had been asked to keep, had been found in her possession. Vera Dukhova felt herself in some measure to blame for her friend's arrest, and implored Nekhludov, who had connections among influential people, to do all he could in order to set this friend free. Besides this, Dukhova asked him to try and get permission for another friend of hers, Gorkevich, who was also imprisoned in the Petropavlovsky fortress, to see his parents, and to procure some scientific books which he required for his studies. Nekhludov promised to do what he could when he went to Petersburg. As to her own story, this is what she said. Having finished a course of midwifery, she became connected with a group of adherents to the Narodovolstvo, and made up her mind to agitate in the revolutionary movement. At first all went on smoothly. She wrote proclamations and occupied herself with propaganda work in the factories. Then, an important member having been arrested, their papers were seized and all concerned were arrested.
"I was also arrested, and shall be exiled. But what does it matter? I feel perfectly happy."
She concluded her story with a piteous smile. Nekhludov made some inquiries concerning the girl with the prominent eyes. Vera Dukhova told him that this girl was the daughter of a general, and had been long attached to the Revolutionary Party, and was arrested because she had pleaded guilty to having shot a gendarme. She lived in a house with some conspirators, where they had a secret printing press. One night when the police came to search this house, the occupiers resolved to defend themselves, put out the light, and began destroying the things that might incriminate them. The police forced their way in, and one of the conspirators fired and mortally wounded a gendarme. When an inquiry was instituted, this girl said that it was she who had fired, although she had never had a revolver in her hands and would not have hurt a fly. And she kept to it, and was now condemned to penal servitude in Siberia.
"An altruistic, fine character," said Vera Dukhova approvingly.
The third business that Vera Dukhova wanted to talk about concerned Maslova. She knew, as everybody does know in prison, the story of Maslova's life and his connection with her, and advised him to take steps to get her removed into the political prisoners' ward, or into the hospital to help to nurse the sick, of which there were very many at that time, so that extra nurses were needed. Nekhludov thanked her for the advice, and said he would try to act upon it. Chapter 56. Nekhludov and the prisoners. Their conversation was interrupted by the inspector, who said that the time was up and the prisoners and their friends must part. Nekhludov took leave of Vera Dukhova and went to the door, where he stopped to watch what was going on. The inspector's order called forth only heightened animation among the prisoners in the room, but no one seemed to think of going. Some rose and continued to talk standing, some went on talking without rising. A few began crying and taking leave of each other. The mother and her consumptive son seemed especially pathetic. The young fellow kept twisting his bit of paper, and his face seemed angry, so great were his efforts not to be infected by his mother's emotion. The mother, hearing that it was time to part, put her head on his shoulder and sobbed, and sniffed aloud. The girl with the prominent eyes, Nekhludov could not help watching her, was standing opposite the sobbing mother and was saying something to her in a soothing tone. The old man with the blue spectacles stood holding his daughter's hand and nodding in answer to what she said. The young lovers rose and, holding each other's hands, looked silently into one another's eyes.
"These are the only two who are merry," said a young man with a short coat, who stood by Nekhludov's side, also looking at those who were about to part, and pointed to the lovers.
Feeling Nekhludov's and the young man's eyes fixed on them, the lovers, the young man with the rubber coat and the pretty girl, stretched out their arms and, with their hands clasped in each other's, danced round and round again.
"Tonight they're going to be married here in prison, and she will follow him to Siberia," said the young man.
"What is he?"
"A convict, condemned to penal servitude. Let those two at least have a little joy, or else it is too painful," the young man added, listening to the sobs of the consumptive lad's mother.
"Now, my good people, please, please do not oblige me to have recourse to severe measures," the inspector said, repeating the same words several times over. "Do please," he went on in a weak, hesitating manner. "It is high time. What do you mean by it? This sort of thing is quite impossible. I'm now asking you for the last time," he repeated wearily, now putting out his cigarette and then lighting another.
It was evident that, artful, old, and common as were the devices enabling men to do evil to others without feeling responsible for it, the inspector could not but feel conscious that he was one of those who were guilty of causing the sorrow which manifested itself in this room. And it was apparent that this troubled him sorely. At length the prisoners and their visitors began to go, the first out of the inner, the latter out of the outer door. The man with the rubber jacket passed out among them, and the consumptive youth, and the dishevelled man. Mary Pavlovna went out with the boy born in prison. The visitors went out, too. The old man with the blue spectacles, stepping heavily, went out, followed by Nekhludov.
"Yes, a strange state of things, this," said the talkative young man, as if continuing an interrupted conversation, as he descended the stairs side by side with Nekhludov. "Yet we have reason to be grateful to the inspector, who does not keep strictly to the rules, kind-hearted fellow. If they can get a talk, it does relieve their hearts a bit, after all."
While talking to the young man, who introduced himself as Medintsev, Nekhludov reached the hall. There the inspector came up to them with weary step.
"If you wish to see Maslova,"
he said, apparently desiring to be polite to Nekhludov, "please come tomorrow." "Very well," answered Nekhludov, and hurried away, experiencing more than ever that sensation of moral nausea which he always felt on entering the prison. The sufferings of the evidently innocent Menshov seemed terrible, and not so much his physical suffering as the perplexity, the distrust in the good and in God which he must feel, seeing the cruelty of the people who tormented him without any reason. Terrible were the disgrace and sufferings cast on these hundreds of guiltless people, simply because something was not written on paper as it should have been. Terrible were the brutalized jailers, whose occupation is to torment their brothers, and who were certain that they were fulfilling an important and useful duty. But most terrible of all seemed this sickly, elderly, kind-hearted inspector, who was obliged to part mother and son, father and daughter, who were just the same sort of people as he and his own children. "What is it all for?" Nekhludov asked himself, and could not find an answer. Chapter 57. The Vice Governors at Home. The next day, Nekhludov went to see the advocate and spoke to him about the Menshov's case, begging him to undertake their defence. The advocate promised to look into the case, and if it turned out to be as Nekhludov said, he would in all probability undertake the defence free of charge. Then Nekhludov told him of the 130 men who were kept in prison owing to a mistake. "On whom did it depend? Whose fault was it?" The advocate was silent for a moment, evidently anxious to give a correct reply.
"Whose fault is it? No one's," he said decidedly. "Ask the procurer, he'll say it is the governor's. Ask the governor, he'll say it is the procurer's fault. No one is in fault."
"I'm just going to see the vice-governor. I shall tell him."
"Oh, that's quite useless," said the advocate with a smile. He is such a... He is not a relation or friend of yours. Such a blockhead, if I may say so, and yet a crafty animal at the same time.
Nekhludov remembered what Maslennikov had said about the advocate, and did not answer, but took leave and went on to Maslennikov's. He had to ask Maslennikov two things, about Maslova's removal to the prison hospital, and about the 130 passportless men innocently imprisoned. Though it was very hard to petition a man whom he did not respect, and by whose orders men were flogged, yet it was the only means of gaining his end, and he had to go through with it. As he drove up to Maslennikov's house, Nekhludov saw a number of different carriages by the front door, and remembered that it was Maslennikov's wife's at-home day, to which she had been invited. At the moment Nekhludov drove up, there was a carriage in front of the door, and a footman in livery, with a cockade in his hat, was helping a lady down the doorstep. She was holding up her train and showing her thin ankles, black stockings, and slippered feet. Among the carriages was a closed landau, which he knew to be the Korchagin's. The grey-haired, red-checked coachman took off his hat and bowed in a respectful yet friendly manner to Nekhludov, as to a gentleman he knew well. Nekhludov had not had time to inquire for Maslennikov when the latter appeared on the carpeted stairs, accompanying a very important guest, not only to the first landing, but to the bottom of the stairs. This very important visitor, a military man, was speaking in French about a lottery for the benefit of children's homes that were to be founded in the city, and expressed the opinion that this was a good occupation for the ladies.
It amuses them, and the money comes.
Qu'il s'amusant et que le bon Dieu le bénisse, Monsieur Nekhludov. How do you do? How is it one never sees you? He greeted Nekhludov. Allez présente vos devoirs à madame, and the Korchagins are here, and Nadine Boukchevden, tous les jolies femmes de la vie,
said the important guest, slightly raising his uniformed shoulders as he presented them to his own richly liveried servant to have his military overcoat put on.
Au revoir, mon cher,
and he pressed Maslennikov's hand.
Now come up, I am so glad,
said Maslennikov, grasping Nekhludov's hand. In spite of his corpulency, Maslennikov hurried quickly up the stairs. He was in particularly good spirits owing to the attention paid him by the important personage. Every such attention gave him the same sense of delight as is felt by an affectionate dog, when its master pats it, strokes it, or scratches its ears. It wags its tail, cringes, jumps about, presses its ears down, and madly rushes about in a circle. Maslennikov was ready to do the same. He did not notice the serious expression on Nekhludov's face, paid no heed to his words, but pulled him irresistibly towards the drawing-room, so that it was impossible for Nekhludov not to follow.
"Business afterwards. I shall do whatever you want," said Maslennikov, as he drew Nekhludov through the dancing-hall. "Announce Prince Nekhludov," he said to a footman, without stopping on his way.
The footman started off at a trot and passed them.
"Vous n'avez qu'ordonné. But you must see my wife. As it is, I got it for letting you go without seeing her last time."
By the time they reached the drawing-room, the footman had already announced Nekhludov, and from between the bonnets and heads that surrounded it, the smiling face of Anna Ignatyevna, the vice-governor's wife, beamed on Nekhludov. At the other end of the drawing-room, several ladies were seated round the tea-table, and some military men and some civilians stood near them. The clatter of male and female voices went on unceasingly.
"Enfin! You seem to have quite forgotten us. How have we offended?"
With these words, intended to convey an idea of intimacy which had never existed between herself and Nekhludov, Anna Ignatyevna greeted the newcomer.
"You are acquainted? Madame Tilyaevsky? Monsieur Chernov? Sit down a bit nearer. Si, venez donc à notre table, on vous apportera votre... the... And you," she said, having evidently forgotten his name, to an officer who was talking to Missy,
"do come here. A cup of tea, Prince?"
"I shall never, never agree with you. It's quite simple. She did not love," a woman's voice was heard saying, "but she loved tarts."
"Oh, your eternally silly jokes,"
put in laughingly another lady resplendent in silks, gold, and jewels.
C'est excellent, these little biscuits, and so light, I think I'll take another. Well, are you moving soon? Yes, this is our last day, that's why we have come. Yes, it must be lovely in the country. We are having a delightful spring.
Missy, with her hat on, in a dark striped dress of some kind that fitted her like a skin, was looking very handsome. She blushed when she saw Nekhludoff.
And I thought you had left, she said to him.
I am on the point of leaving. Business is keeping me in town, and it is on business I have come here.
Won't you come to see Mama? She would like to see you, she said.
And knowing that she was saying what was not true, and that he knew it also, she blushed still more. I fear I shall scarcely have time, Nekhludoff said gloomily, trying to appear as if he had not noticed her blush. Missy frowned angrily, shrugged her shoulders, and turned towards an elegant officer who grasped the empty cup she was holding, and knocking his sword against the chairs, manfully carried the cup across to another table.
You must contribute towards the home fund.
I'm not refusing, but only wish to keep my bounty fresh for the lottery. There I shall let it appear in all its glory.
Well, look out for yourself,
said a voice, followed by an evidently feigned laugh. Anna Ignatievna was in raptures. Her at-home had turned out a brilliant success.
"Mickey tells me you are busying yourself with prison work. I can understand you so well," she said to Nekhludoff. "Mickey," she meant her fat husband, Maslennikov, "may have other defects, but you know how kind-hearted he is. All these miserable prisoners are his children. He does not regard them in any other light. Il est d'une bonté."
And she stopped, finding no words to do justice to this bonte of his, and quickly turned to a shrivelled old woman with bows of lilac ribbon all over who came in just then. Having said as much as was absolutely necessary, and with as little meaning as conventionality required, Nekhludoff rose and went up to Maslennikov.
"Can you give me a few minutes' hearing, please?"
"Oh, yes. Well, what is it?"
"Let us come in here."
They entered a small Japanese sitting room, and sat down by the window. Chapter 58. The Vice Governor Suspicious.
"Well, je suis à vous. Will you smoke? But wait a bit. We must be careful and not make a mess here,"
said Maslennikov, and brought an ashpan.
"Well?"
"There are two matters I wish to ask you about."
"Dear me."
An expression of gloom and dejection came over Maslennikov's countenance, and every trace of the excitement, like that of the dogs whom its master has scratched behind the ears, vanished completely. The sound of voices reached them from the drawing-room. A woman's voice was heard saying,
"Jamais je ne croirai,"
and a man's voice from the other side relating something in which the names of la Comtesse Vorontsov and Victor Apraksine kept recurring. A hum of voices, mixed with laughter, came from another side. Maslennikov tried to listen to what was going on in the drawing-room, and to what Nekhludoff was saying at the same time. "I'm again come about that same woman," said Nekhludoff.
"Oh, yes, I know, the one innocent they condemned."
"I would like to ask that she should be appointed to serve in the prison hospital. I have been told that this could be arranged."
Maslennikov compressed his lips and meditated.
"That will be scarcely possible,"
he said.
"However, I shall see what can be done, and shall wire you an answer tomorrow."
"I have been told that there were many sick, and help was needed."
"All right, all right. I shall let you know in any case."
"Please do," said Nekhludoff.
The sound of a general and even a natural laugh came from the drawing-room.
"That's all that Victor. He is wonderfully sharp when he is in the right vein," said Maslennikov.
"The next thing I wanted to tell you," said Nekhludoff, "is that 130 persons are imprisoned only because their passports are overdue. They have been kept here a month."
And he related the circumstances of the case.
"How have you come to know of this?"
said Maslennikov, looking uneasy and dissatisfied.
"I went to see a prisoner, and these men came and surrounded me in the corridor and asked..."
"What prisoner did you go to see?"
"A peasant who was kept in prison, though innocent. I have put his case into the hands of a lawyer. But that is not the point. Is it possible that people who have done no wrong are imprisoned only because their passports are overdue, and—"
"That's the procurer's business,"
Maslennikov interrupted angrily.
"There, now, you see what it is you call a prompt and just form of trial. It is the business of the public prosecutor to visit the prison and to find out if the prisoners are kept there lawfully. But that set play cards. That's all they do."
"Am I to understand that you can do nothing?" Nekhludov said, despondently, remembering that the advocate had foretold that the governor would put the blame on the procurator.
"Oh, yes, I can. I shall see about it at once."
"So much the worse for her, c'est un souffre-douleur,"
came the voice of a woman, evidently indifferent to what she was saying, from the drawing-room.
"So much the better. I shall take it also,"
a man's voice was heard to say from the other side, followed by the playful laughter of a woman who was apparently trying to prevent the man from taking something away from her.
"No, no, not on any account," the woman's voice said.
"All right, then, I shall do all this,"
Maslennikov repeated, and put out the cigarette he held in his white, turquoise-ringed hand.
"And now let us join the ladies."
"Wait a moment," Nekhludov said, stopping at the door of the drawing-room. "I was told that some men had received corporal punishment in the prison yesterday. Is this true?" Maslennikov blushed.
"Oh, that's what you're after. No, mon cher, decidedly it won't do to let you in there. You want to get at everything. Come, come, Anna is calling us," he said, catching Nekhludov by the arm,
and again becoming as excited as after the attention paid him by the important person. Only now his excitement was not joyful, but anxious. Nekhludov pulled his arm away, and without taking leave of anyone and without saying a word, he passed through the drawing-room with a dejected look, went down into the hall, past the footman, who sprang towards him, and out at the street door.
"What is the matter with him? What have you done to him?"
asked Anna of her husband.
"This is à la française," remarked someone.
"À la française, indeed. It is à la Zulu."
"Oh, but he's always been like that."
Someone rose, someone came in, and the clatter went on its course. The company used this episode with Nekhludov as a convenient topic of conversation for the rest of the at-home. On the day following his visit to Maslennikov, Nekhludov received a letter from him written in a fine, firm hand on thick, glazed paper, with a coat of arms and sealed with sealing wax. Maslennikov said that he had written to the doctor concerning Maslova's removal to the hospital and hoped Nekhludov's wish would receive attention. The letter was signed, "Your affectionate elder comrade," and the signature ended with a large, firm, and artistic flourish.
"Fool,"
Nekhludov could not refrain from saying, especially because in the word comrade he felt Maslennikov's condescension towards him. I.e., while Maslennikov was filling this position, morally most dirty and shameful, he still thought himself a very important man, and wished, if not exactly to flatter Nekhludov, at least to show that he was not too proud to call him comrade. Chapter 59. Nekhludov's third interview with Maslova in prison. One of the most widespread superstitions is that every man has his own special, definite qualities, that a man is kind, cruel, wise, stupid, energetic, apathetic, etc. Men are not like that. We may say of a man that he is more often kind than cruel, oftener wise than stupid, oftener energetic than apathetic, or the reverse. But it would be false to say of one man that he is kind and wise, of another that he is wicked and foolish. And yet we always classify mankind in this way. And this is untrue. Men are like rivers. The water is the same in each, and alike in all. But every river is narrow here, is more rapid there, here slower, there broader, now clear, now cold, now dull, now warm. It is the same with men. Every man carries in himself the germs of every human quality, and sometimes one manifests itself, sometimes another, and the man often becomes unlike himself, while still remaining the same man. In some people these changes are very rapid, and Nekhludov was such a man. These changes in him were due to physical and to spiritual causes. At this time he experienced such a change. That feeling of triumph and joy at the renewal of life which he had experienced after the trial and after the first interview with Katyusha vanished completely, and after the last interview fear and revulsion took the place of that joy. He was determined not to leave her, and not to change his decision of marrying her if she wished it. But it seemed very hard, and made him suffer. On the day after his visit to Maslennikov, he again went to the prison to see her. The inspector allowed him to speak to her, only not in the advocate's room nor in the office, but in the women's visiting room. In spite of his kindness, the inspector was more reserved with Nekhludov than hitherto. An order for greater caution had apparently been sent as a result of his conversation with Maslennikov.
"You may see her," the inspector said, "but please remember what I said as regards money. And as to her removal to the hospital that His Excellency wrote to me about, it can be done. The doctor would agree, only she herself does not wish it. She says, much need have I to carry out the slops for the scurvy beggars. You don't know what these people are, Prince," he added.
Nekhludov did not reply, but asked to have the interview. The inspector called a jailer, whom Nekhludov followed into the women's visiting room, where there was no one but Maslova waiting. She came from behind the grating, quiet and timid, close up to him, and said, without looking at him,
"Forgive me, Dmitri Ivanovitch. I spoke hastily the day before yesterday."
"It is not for me to forgive you," Nekhludov began.
"But all the same, you must leave me,"
she interrupted, and in the terribly squinting eyes with which she looked at him, Nekhludov read the former, strained, angry expression. "Why should I leave you?"
"So."
"But why so?" She again looked up, as it seemed to him, with the same angry look.
"Well, then, thus it is," she said. "You must leave me. It is true what I am saying. I cannot. You just give it up altogether."
Her lips trembled, and she was silent for a moment.
"It is true. I'd rather hang myself."
Nekhludov felt that in this refusal there was hatred and unforgiving resentment, but there was also something besides, something good. This confirmation of the refusal in cold blood at once quenched all the doubts in Nekhludov's bosom and brought back the serious, triumphant emotion he had felt in relation to Katyusha. "Katyusha, what I have said I will again repeat," he uttered very seriously. "I ask you to marry me. If you do not wish it, and for as long as you do not wish it, I shall only continue to follow you, and shall go where you are taken."
"That is your business. I shall not say anything more," she answered, and her lips began to tremble again.
He too was silent, feeling unable to speak. "I shall now go to the country, and then to Petersburg," he said when he was quieter again. "I shall do my utmost to get our case, I mean, reconsidered, and by the help of God the sentence may be revoked."
"And if it is not revoked, never mind. I have deserved it, if not in this case, in other ways," she said,
and he saw how difficult it was for her to keep down her tears.
"Well, have you seen Menshov?"
she suddenly asked, to hide her emotion.
"It's true they are innocent, isn't it?"
"Yes, I think so."
"Such a splendid old woman," she said.
There was another pause.
"Well, and as to the hospital,"
she suddenly said, and looking at him with her squinting eyes,
"if you like, I will go, and I shall not drink any spirits either."
Nekhludov looked into her eyes. They were smiling. "Yes, yes, she is quite a different being," Nekhludov thought. After all his former doubts, he now felt something he had never before experienced. The certainty that love is invincible.